12 years old. My dad was home for a few years, 3 years, I think, total. But about that time, he became obsessed with teaching me how to defend myself. I was very small for my age, and I think it must have worried him that bigger guys would be picking on me. Now, I had made friends with some of the biggest guys in school. And the guys that were not my friends, I could outrun. So I had a plan in place. It's not like I needed that. But my dad was unrelenting to teach me how to defeat my opponent. And one aspect of what he taught me involved what we would refer to as balance and stability. How to get someone off their balance while maintaining yours. One of the things he used to teach me to do was to grab somebody by a shirt and pull them towards you, because their initial reaction would be to do what? To pull away. So as soon as you pulled them towards you, you would then push back, put your foot behind them, and take them down. And their own momentum would carry them down. You didn't have to be very big to do that. These are the kind of things that I was mentored with growing up. Balance and stability, however, they're central whenever we're in any sort of a physical engagement with anyone, whether we're talking about a combat situation or we're just talking about sports. From hand-to-hand combat to sumo wrestling, you watch a linebacker get up on the line. You watch any football player, when they take their position, they set their feet. When a quarterback doesn't get a pass off right, they'll say he wasn't in position. His feet weren't set. It's imperative to have your balance set from your feet through your legs up through the rest of your body. We have to have that in order to stand, or else we fall. In basic training, our drill instructor would actually walk around behind us and kick our legs out if they were in the wrong position. You wouldn't see it coming. He was only like 5'6", and so he was back there somewhere. And he would come up behind you out of nowhere, and he'd just kick your leg out. And if you weren't in the right position, he'd take you down. If you were, you'd be able to withstand it. I took karate for a very short period of time, and the sensei would walk around and check to make sure in a fighting stance that your right leg was back, your foot was cocked, and you were in a squared position. And if it wasn't, then he would take the time to work with you to get that taken care of. Imperative to have your balance so that you have stability. You can't protect yourself while you're falling, and you can't fight back from the ground. Now, I did learn things both from my dad and from the military, and even a few things from my short stint in karate class. But while all of that has never come in handy, I know how to break a neck from behind from being in the military. I have never had to do that. And I am thrilled to have information I'll never have to use. But none of that, nothing my dad taught me, nothing I learned in sports, nothing I learned in the military or karate, none of that could prepare me for an opponent that I can't see. For an enemy that's not physical, but an enemy that's spiritual. For that kind of battle, a far greater teacher is required. And a different perspective on what constitutes those issues of balance and stability in order to be able to stand and not fall. To this end, we're going to turn to our instructor today, the Apostle Paul. We're going to really be focusing on just verse 13 today, but we're going to carry on as we have been reading chapter 6, verses 10 through 18. Finally, my brethren, be strong in the Lord and in the power of his might. Put on the whole armor of God, that you may be able to stand against the wiles of the devil. For we wrestle not against flesh and blood, but against principalities, against powers, against the rulers of the darkness of this world, against spiritual wickedness in high places. Wherefore, take unto you the whole armor of God, that you may be able to withstand in the evil day, and having done all, to stand. Stand, therefore, having your loins girt about with truth, and having on the breastplate of righteousness, and your feet shod with the preparation of the gospel of peace, above all taking the shield of faith, wherewith you shall be able to quench all the fiery darts of the wicked. And take the helmet of salvation and the sword of the Spirit, which is the Word of God. Praying always with all prayer and supplication in the Spirit, and watching thereunto with all perseverance and supplication for all saints. In theological terms, when we speak about our salvation, we will use a big word that's called monergistic. When we say salvation is monergistic, what we are saying is that salvation is of God alone. He is the source and He is the cause of our redemption, and it is not in us in any part that is a responsible for that. That is monergism. God is singularly responsible for our salvation. But when we speak about our walk with the Lord as believers, what is God's work alone to redeem us, our walk with the Lord is called synergistic. That means that it is a cooperative work with God and ourselves. While He remains the source and cause of what we do, we become, in cooperation with Him, the means that He wants to accomplish His work here. All of these verses in Ephesians 6, 10 through 18 are about this work of synergism. As verse 10, we see, we are told to be strong. We are told to be strong. And yet, it is by His power and His might and not our own. You see how that's working? We are strong, but it's not our strength. It's His power and His strength. Verse 11 says, we must put on the whole armor of God. But that armor belongs to God. That armor comes from God. And that armor is sustained in its function for us by God. So while we walk with God, there is never a time in our life as believers when our work that we do is not in essence only His work in us. That's why Christians are not to be prideful or arrogant about what they accomplish. Whenever it always bothers me, I know a lot of people do it, and I'm not making distinctions here, but whenever I see a ministry that has the leader of that ministry's name above the door, I think he's pointing to the wrong person for what's going on there. I think that's just an error, and grievously so. Now, we do get the visual credit often for what has been done, but in reality, it is what He has done and is doing within us. There's nothing about my life, nothing that I've ever accomplished as a believer, ever, that was ever the result of anything that I am, but always the result of who I am based upon what God has done in me. I would be nothing were it not for that. We're going to talk about this later, but I believe it's in the book of Isaiah where it talks about the fact that shall the axe boast itself against the one who holds it? And so a good axe is important, and that axe is the instrument that cuts the tree down, but it's God that holds the axe, and we're the axe. So maybe we're involved in the cutting of the tree, but we can't do anything at all unless the one who holds us also then swings us. When we attempt to accomplish His work and our own strength, then it is simply not His work anymore. It has no eternal value whatsoever and no reward. When we are doing things, no matter what that might be, no matter how good that work might be, there is no eternal reward for that and no eternal value unless it is the result of what God is doing in me, and it is in His power, and it is in His might, and it is through the gift that He has granted to me. Everything goes back always to Him and not me. So decent people can do good things. Even Christian people can do good things and start good works and do other things. But unless that is of God, no matter who you are, it has no eternal value or reward. His work is in us and through us and by us, or it's not his work. He is the source and cause. We are the means by cooperation. Now, three times in four verses from our text, we are told to stand. Whenever you find just a basic form of exposition in anything you do, if you find something repeated over and over again, especially in a short section of Scripture, you want to pay attention to that. If God is repeating something, He means for us to pay attention to what He's repeating. And three times in four verses from our text, we are told to stand. Once we are told to withstand, so that's another one that comes into play. But three times in particular, we are told to stand. But unlike the military, unlike playing sports or karate or my dad's obsession, we must not think about that in terms of some self-determined stance. We can't see ourselves, as Americans often do, as being the ones that are going to charge ahead and get this done. Let me tell you about Texas. They really don't need the rest of the country. They might use your stuff and they'll be happy to get your stuff, but and they appreciate everybody that's come from every place, but those are people that they're bootstrap people. That's who they are. Often, as Americans, we think ourselves in that same way. If something's going to get done, we've got to put our hands to that plow and get it done. And we're only thinking in terms of what we need to do and how we need to function, and we're not thinking about the fact that it is, if it's going to be something of God, then the work has to be His work in us, not our work we're trying to place His name on. And must be as the result of God's armor acting in and upon us. The word stance, histemi, in the Greek, means to make, to stand by appointment. When I thought about this word, I thought about guard duty. If you were in the military at all, you always get guard duty. Everybody goes through a time of guard duty. Guard duty can consist of them placing you in front of a door or a building and putting you in one spot and saying, don't move. So you stand and you watch that door. Nobody gets in or out without going through you, or you're watching there to protect what's going on there. Often guard duty for us, they stuck us out one time, two of us, out in a deserted area. There was nothing there. It was an empty building, and it was right next to the prison. And it was pitch black. And they wanted us to walk around separately from each other, only passing on the back side of the building all night. And we decided that until somebody came, we were going to walk together. And we changed our mind. But it's by appointment. Somebody comes to you and they say, go stand there. Go stand over here. Go walk this perimeter. The word stand means to make, to stand by appointment. It also means to be made able to abide, to continue, or to hold up as called. We were trained for guard duty. We were trained how to walk. We were trained how to dress. We were trained how to carry our weapons. We were trained what to do if someone approached, how to stop them, what the code words were for the evening. All of these things came by training. We were made able and we were appointed to stand. We didn't take this upon ourselves. We didn't see ourselves as the source that, look, there's a door over there. Let's go stand in front of that door and be guards. It came by appointment, and our appointment to stand comes from God, and it is He who makes us able. The armor of God received with the grace it's given in whole makes us able to withstand the opposition. 1 Corinthians 10:12, in fact, says, let him, underline, who thinks he stands, take heed lest he fall. That's the key in this word. Let him who thinks he stands take heed lest he fall. If you think you're capable of doing that on your own, and you're brazen enough and arrogant enough to do so, beware, because the fall is probably right around the corner. Turn to 2 Corinthians chapter 12, verses 7 through 10. The Apostle Paul speaking here. He says, "Unless I should be exalted above measure through the abundance of the revelations, there was given to me a thorn in the flesh, the messenger of Satan, to buffet me, lest I should be exalted above measure. For this thing I besought the Lord three times, that it might depart from me. And he said unto me, My grace is sufficient for you, for my strength is made perfect in weakness. Most gladly, therefore, will I rather glory in my infirmities, that the power of Christ may rest upon me. Therefore, I take pleasure in infirmities and reproaches and necessities and persecutions and distresses for Christ's sake. For when I am weak, then I am strong." Those are all things in which we often find ourselves feeling less than strong. Prior to the Damascus Road experience, Paul, who was then known as Saul, was a very prideful, brazen, and fearless man in pursuit of the highest position in all of Israel. This was a part of his character, part of who he was, that plagued him at times throughout his life as a Christian. He says, "Unless I should be exalted in myself," is what he's saying, "above measure," because the Lord had given him an abundance of revelations that had separated him from the pack, so to speak. And he says, "Unless I get full of myself," so that doesn't happen by the abundance of these revelations that I have, and then I start becoming the apostle me instead of the apostle Paul. The Lord said, he gave Paul a thorn in the flesh. Now, we don't know what that was, and there's all sorts of theories about that. I think I'm the only one that knows the answer to that. I'm only kidding. But I believe it was his persecution of the church, that when Paul would start to feel arrogant about himself, that they would send a messenger to remind him that he had persecuted Christians and thrown them into prison, that he had persecuted the church of the living God. The Lord was turning him from his own power to the power of Jesus Christ to help him see that human strength is actually weakness, and that we are most strong in the Lord when we are least dependent upon ourselves. Psalm 20, verses 7 through 8. Let me read that to you quickly here. Psalm 27 through 8 says, "Some trust in chariots and some in horses, but we will remember the name of the Lord our God. They are brought down and fallen, but we are risen and stand upright." You have to be careful what you are trusting in, and understand that at all times, no matter what it is you're engaged in, the battle belongs to the Lord, not to you. Proverbs 12:7 says, "The wicked are overthrown and are not, but the house of the righteous shall stand." 1 John 4:4, "Listen, greater is he that is within me than he that's in the world." But notice what it says. "He is greater, not me." His greatness doesn't make me great. It makes him great. I reap the benefit of his greatness, but I am not great. Greater is he that is in me than he that's in the world, not me. Listen, even Michael the archangel, when confronted by Satan over the body of Moses, did not go R-K-E-R-K, or mano e mano, we'll say R-K-E-R-K, with Satan. He didn't butt heads with him and said, "Listen, we're both archangels, let's just duke it out and see who comes out on top." He said, "The Lord rebuke you." That's in Jude 9. James says, "Submit to God, resist the devil, and he will flee." That word resist is translated withstand. It's the same word in Ephesians 6 when it says withstand. You may be able to withstand. James uses the word, or it's translated there, resist the devil. But we don't resist the devil by planting our feet. We don't resist the devil by some steely determination that he's not going to get the best of us or the best of me. Because listen, the exertion of your will is no match for him. At all. Turn to 1 Peter chapter 5. Because we have to ask that question, then how do we then resist? What are the elements of resisting the devil? Start in verse 6, reading through verse 11. Humble yourselves, therefore, under the mighty hand of God, that he may exalt you in due time, casting all your care upon him, for he cares for you. Be sober, be vigilant, because your adversary the devil is a roaring lion, walketh about seeking whom he may devour, whom resists steadfast in the faith, knowing that the same afflictions are accomplished in your brethren that are in the world. But the God of all grace, who hath called us unto his eternal glory by Christ Jesus, after that you have suffered a while, make you perfect, establish, strengthen, settle you. To him be glory and dominion forever and ever. Amen. Verse 6 says, we resist by being humble. Because we need what in order to survive? Grace. God gives grace, verse 5, the last part of verse 5. God resists the proud. God withstands the proud. He stands against the proud, in opposition to the proud, but he gives grace to the humble. So humble yourselves, therefore, under the mighty hand of God, that he may exalt you in due time. We need grace to stand. The power of God, not our own pride. Verse 7, we resist by faith, by not allowing the cares and stresses of this world to overwhelm us or to distract us from where our focus should be. Casting all your cares upon him, for he cares for you. If you're overwhelmed with everything that's going on in your life, you have two options when that happens to you. One is to be overwhelmed and distracted by those cares, because the cares are probably not going to go away. Or to stop, see them for what they are, and to cast your cares upon him. Nothing I've ever fretted about that I can think of, off the top of my head, nothing I've ever fretted about or stressed about ever turned out the way I thought it was going to. I've had things turn out worse. But generally speaking, that's not the case. Things happen. You worry about them. It just doesn't develop the way you think it's going to. You have cancer, the doctor says. I'm dying. No, it's on your hand and we can cut that out of there. We can take care of it. Oh, that's different. The word itself. Here's the daylights out of it. Before you even know what it is or what can be done. But even if it's the worst thing, is anything that you're stressed about going to change that outcome? So you have to take those cares and cast them upon him. Verse 8, we resist by being sober and vigilant against the deceptions or the wiles in Ephesians 6 of the devil. Now, I checked this story out a long, long time ago, many, many years ago. But when I did, it says, your adversary, the devil, is a roaring lion, walks about seeking whom he may devour. And the story that I've always seen from this, if anybody knows it's incorrect, let me know, is that when a lion gets old and can no longer hunt, the young lions use him as a distraction. And he goes out behind the prey, and he roars because he can't chase him anymore. When he gets there, he's got to hope his denture cream's holding because them teeth ain't that good. And so he roars. What happens? the gazelles, the whatever it is the lions are after, run, and the young lions are waiting in the weeds where they're running to take them down. That's the devil. He makes a lot of noise, but you belong to the Lord. You belong to the Lord. You belong to the Lord. He is a big mouth making a lot of noise who has no power to do anything to you. He didn't go to heaven with Job and say, stand before the throne and say, yeah, here, by the way, here's what I'm doing. Job, way too good of a guy. I'm taking his life away. I'm taking his stuff away. I'm killing his children. I'm doing what I want to do with him, and you're going to have to deal with it. He had to go to the Lord and say, can I do this? And the Lord said, you have my permission to do this, but here's a line you can't cross. Who was in charge? He couldn't have done anything had the Lord not given him permission. He acts by permission. He has no teeth. Verse 9, we resist by remaining steadfast in the faith, by not allowing the truth of the gospel, the truth of God's word, to be polluted or compromised. Not to let somebody whisper in your ear that God's word is not what it is. Eve stood in the garden and let the devil whisper in her ear. Now, he didn't say that. He didn't mean you'd really die. Oh, and by the way, he just doesn't want you to be like him, and that's what's going to happen if you eat of that tree. And she listened to that instead of listening to the truth. You stand steadfast in the truth. Listen, the problem with Joel Osteen isn't that he didn't open his building up, or he did open his building up, or whatever that truth may be. He doesn't know the gospel. That's the problem. We only stand on the truth without that being compromised. That's the bigger issue. Verse 10, we resist even when we are suffering, because ultimately we need to know that God has a greater purpose at work in us in that suffering. In fact, the word would indicate that all who live godly shall suffer persecution, but that also that we develop a more intimate relationship and our understanding of the Lord when we suffer as he suffered. Not in the same meaning, and not by crucifixion, I'm not saying that, but that suffering itself, what it does to the body, when we trust the Lord, helps us to have a greater understanding of what he went through for us. It builds us up. It's not meant to tear us down. Romans 5:2 says we stand in God's grace. 1 Corinthians 16:13, we stand in faith. 1 Corinthians 15:1, we stand in the gospel. 1 Thessalonians 3:8, we stand in the Lord. In no verse, no place do we stand by our own will. Not one place. Where does grace come from? For by grace are we saved through faith. Same place faith comes from. Where? It's a gift of God. You don't have it inherent in your body. You weren't born with faith. You don't have grace. God gives them to you. They're a gift. Not a gift if you work for it, is it? Not a gift if you already have it, is it? It's in the truth of the gospel, and it's in him. Verse 11 settles that. To him be glory and dominion forever and ever. Amen. How do we stand? We stand in him, giving him the glory and the honor forever and ever. Our focus is on him. He gets all of the credit, every little bit of it. Listen, David faced Goliath without pride. Don't think for a minute that he ran down there full of pride and full of himself, just ready to take that giant down. That's a bunch of baloney. Listen, 1 Samuel 17 is not about how to conquer your giants. Somebody teaches that to you, they don't understand that text. It's about God being glorified by his choice of weapon. David wasn't the hero of 1 Samuel 17. He was the instrument in God's hand. God is the only hero. He's the only hero. There are no men that are the heroes of faith. Not their faith. Was given to them by God. Then it became theirs, but even their ability to exercise that faith is the result of the work of God in them. They get no credit for that. They get to use it, they get the benefit of it, but it's His work. He does it. Now, I'm going to close out here. We're going to read. Go to 1 Samuel 17. We're going to read the whole chapter. We're going to break it down into little pieces. I'm not going to exposit the whole thing. I just want you to see in this text how this entire story played out. 1 Samuel 17, we're going to read verses 1 through 11. Step 1, this is the setting of the stage in the valley of Elah. God is setting the stage for what's going to happen. Now the Philistines gathered together their armies to battle and were gathered together at Shoko, which belongs to Judah, and pitched between Shoko and Azekah in Ephesdamin. And Saul and the men of Israel were gathered together and pitched by the valley of Elah and set the battle in array against the Philistines, two armies on two sides of a valley. And the Philistines stood on a mountain on the one side, and Israel stood on a mountain on the other side, and there was a valley between them. And there went out a champion of the camp of the Philistines named Goliath of Gath, whose height was 6 cubits and a span. Depending upon how you figure that out, that's somewhere between 9'8" and 12'1". He's a big guy. If he went to my high school, I would have made friends with him. Then I wouldn't have cared about any of the other big guys. He had a helmet of brass upon his head, and he was armed with a coat of mail, and the weight of the coat was 5,000 shekels of brass. He had greaves of brass upon his legs and a target of brass between his shoulders, and the staff of his spear was like a weaver's beam, and his spear's head weighed 600 shekels of iron, 20 pounds, by the way, and in one bearing a shield went before him, and he stood and cried unto the armies of Israel and said unto them, "Why are you come out to set your battle in array? Am I not a Philistine and you servants to Saul? Choose you a man for you and let him come down to me. And if he be able to fight with me and kill me, then will we be your servants. And if I prevail against him and kill him, then shall be your servants. You shall be our servants and serve us." And the Philistine said, "I defy the armies of Israel this day. Give me a man that we may fight together." When Saul and all Israel heard those words of the Philistines, they were dismayed and greatly afraid. Goliath was a seasoned war veteran. He was bigger and more powerful by far than anyone Israel could possibly muster up. Saul, who was one of the biggest men in Israel, was only head and shoulders above the average man in Israel, and Goliath was far bigger than him. They were overwhelmed with fear, and it says their morale was broken. Verses 12 through 24, step 2, God's providence calls David to the battlefield, 12 through 24. Now David was the son of that Ephrathite of Bethlehem, Judah, whose name was Jesse, and he had 8 sons, and the man went among men for an old man in the days of Saul. And the 3 oldest sons of Jesse went and followed Saul to the battle, and the names of his 3 sons that went to the battle were Eliab, the firstborn, and next to him Abinadab, and the 3rd Shema. And David was the youngest, and the 3 eldest followed Saul. But David went and returned from Saul to feed his father's sheep at Bethlehem. He had gone evidently when his brothers went with them, but he didn't stay. He returned. He followed them to the field and then went back home. And the Philistine drew near morning and evening. Every day, morning and evening, Goliath was coming and taunting them for 40 days. And Jesse said unto David his son, "Take now for your brethren, for your brothers, an ephah of this parched corn and these 10 loaves, and run to the camp to thy brethren, and carry these 10 cheeses unto the captain of their 1,000, and look how your brethren are faring, and take their pledge." Get the word from them on how they're faring, because guess what? They didn't have the internet. There was no phone service, no Twitter, no text, no nothing. If you weren't there, you didn't know what was going on unless somebody came and told you. Now Saul and they and all the men of Israel were in the valley of Elah fighting with the Philistines, and David rose up early in the morning and left the sheep with a keeper and took and went as Jesse had commanded him. And he came to the trench as the host was going forth to fight and shouted for the battle. For Israel and the Philistines had put the battle in array, army against army. And David left his carriage in the hand of the keeper of the carriage and ran into the army and came and saluted his brother and his brothers. And as he talked with them, behold, there came up the champion, the Philistine of Gath, Goliath by name, out of the armies of the Philistines, and spoke according to the same words and that he'd been speaking, and David heard them. And all the men of Israel, when they saw the man, fled from him and were sore afraid. So David, listen, he didn't wake up that day looking for a fight. He wasn't even aware of the situation at Elah. Two armies facing off. You know anything about Goliath? He was sent by Jesse, his father, to deliver food to his brethren and to get word back about their welfare. And that's all he knew when he left. By God's providence, David knew nothing about what he was stepping into. Nothing at all. Verses 25 through 31, step 3. David is indignant because he's able to perceive that there's a greater issue going on here than two armies. And yet we'll see that his faith is going to be perceived as pride and an evil motive. So let's read 25 through 31. And the men of Israel said, "Have you seen this man that has come up?" And that's, I can see him saying, "Have you seen this guy? He's huge. Surely to defy Israel as he come up, and it shall be that the man who kills him, the king will enrich him with great riches and will give him his daughter and make his father's house free in Israel." I don't know what his daughter looked like. Not sure if that's a good thing or a bad thing. And David spoke to the men that stood by him, saying, "What shall be done to the man that kills this Philistine and takes away the reproach from Israel?" He saw it as a reproach on Israel. "For who is this uncircumcised Philistine that he should defy the armies of" who? "The living God." Not of Saul, of the living God. And the people answered him after this manner, saying, "So shall it be done to the man that kills him." And Eliab, his eldest brother, heard when he spoke, when David spoke unto the men. And Eliab's anger was kindled against David. He said, "Why did you come down here? And with whom have you left those few sheep in the wilderness? I know your pride and the naughtiness of your heart, for thou art come down that thou mightest see the battle." He questioned why he even came. And David said, "What have I now done? Is there not a cause here?" And he turned from him towards another and spake after the same manner. And the people answered him again after the former manner. David saying, "Why aren't you going down and challenging this guy? He's standing against the armies of the living God. God is greater than him." And the people said, "Have you seen the guy? He's huge. We're not going down there. You want to go down there, that's fine. You get to marry the king's daughter." And when the words were heard which David spake, they rehearsed them before Saul, and he sent for him. So word of David's reproach upon Israel by his words came to the ears of Saul. David's indignant because that he perceives the truth here. It is God that defies Israel, not this giant. 32 to 37, step 4, the willingness of David, we'll see, is grounded in God, not himself. 32 to 37, "And David said to Saul, 'Let no man's heart fail because of him. Your servant will go and fight with this Philistine.' And Saul said to David, 'You're not able to go against this Philistine to fight with him, for you are but a youth, and he a man of war from his youth.' And David said unto Saul, 'Your servant kept his father's sheep, and there came a lion and a bear and took a lamb out of the flock. And I went out after him and smote him and delivered it out of his mouth. And when he arose against me, I caught him by the beard and smote him and slew him. Your servant slew both the lion and the bear, and this uncircumcised Philistine shall be as one of them, seeing he hath defied the armies of the living God.'" Now that sounds pretty arrogant, doesn't it? If you'd stop right there. Listen, I killed a lion and a bear. I can certainly kill this guy. But he goes on. David said moreover in verse 37, "The Lord that delivered me out of the paw of the lion and out of the paw of the bear, he will deliver me out of the hand of this Philistine." And Saul said unto David, "Go, and the Lord be with you." He's telling the story about killing a lion and a bear, and if he had stopped right there, it would sound pretty prideful. But he says, "Listen, I understand this. I'm just a ruddy-faced boy watching some sheep. God gave me the courage. God moved my legs to go. God slew the lion and the bear. I was his instrument. And I'll be his instrument when I go down to that field and face that Philistine." That's what he's saying. 38 and 39, David is going to choose the proven armor of God over the armor of Saul. And Saul armed David with his armor, and he put a helmet of brass upon his head. Also, he armed him with a coat of mail. And David girded his sword upon his armor, and he attempted to go, for he had And he attempted to go, for he had not proved it. And David said unto Saul, I cannot go with these, for I have not proved them. And David put them off him. He didn't wear armor when he went to fight the lion and the bear. He's not going to wear that armor when he goes to fight the Philistine. Why? Because he's got the armor of God. And he's going to go in that. Verses 40 through the rest of the chapter, David proceeds to prove God, not to prove David. And he took his staff in his hand and chose him 5 smooth stones out of the brook and put them in a shepherd's bag, which he had even in a scrip. And his sling was in his hand, and he drew near the Philistine. And the Philistine came on and drew near unto David. And the man that bare the shield went before him. And when the Philistine looked about and saw David, he disdained him, for he was but a youth and ruddy and of a fair countenance. The Philistine said unto David, am I a dog that you come to me with staves? And the Philistine cursed David by his God. And the Philistine said to David, come to me, and I will give your flesh into the fowls of the air and to the beasts of the field. Nowadays in the movies, he'd be sitting there going like this. That's what they do in the movies when they want you to come. Then said David to the Philistine, you come to me with a sword and with a spear and with a shield, but I come to you in the name of the Lord of hosts, the God of the armies of Israel, whom you have defied. This day will the Lord deliver you into my hand, and I will smite you and take your head from you, and I will give the carcass of the host of the Philistines this day into the fowls of the air and to the wild beasts of the earth, that all the earth may know that there is a God in Israel. And all this assembly shall know that the Lord saves, not with sword and spear, for the battle is the Lord's, and he will give you into our hand. And it came to pass when the Philistine arose and came and drew nigh to meet David, that David hasted and ran toward the army to meet the Philistine. And David put his hand in his bag and took hence a stone and slung it, and it smote the Philistine in his forehead. It was a large target. And the stone sunk into his forehead, and he fell upon his face to the ground. So David prevailed over the Philistine with a sling and with a stone, and smote the Philistine and slew him. But there was no sword in the hand of David. Therefore David ran and stood upon the Philistine and took his sword and drew it out of the sheath thereof and slew him and cut off his head therewith. And when the Philistines saw their champion was dead, they fled. They didn't do what they said they were going to do. We'll be your servants, because they thought, that'll never happen. And now here they are. And the men of Israel and of Judah arose and shouted and pursued the Philistines. Now they got courage until they came to the valley of the gates of Ekron, and the wounded of the Philistines fell down by the way to Shearim, even unto Gath and to Ekron. And the children of Israel returned from chasing after the Philistines, and they spoiled their tents. And David took the head of the Philistine and brought it to Jerusalem, and he put his armor in his tent. And when Saul saw David go forth against the Philistine, he said unto Abner, the captain of the host, Abner, whose son is this youth? And Abner says, as your soul lives, O king, I don't know. And the king said, inquire thou whose son the stripling is. And as David returned from the slaughter of the Philistine, Abner took him and brought him before Saul with the head of the Philistine in his hand. And then Saul said, whose son are you? And he says, I'm the servant, the son of Jesse the Bethlehemite. How many stones did he choose? 5. How many stones did he use? 1. I mean, he didn't go so far as to assume how God was going to make this happen. He just knew it was going to happen. So he went prepared, didn't he? He didn't say that one stone was going to bring this guy down, but that's all he used, and that's all he needed. Listen, we wake up every morning with plans. I do. In fact, I usually go to bed at night, and the last thing I do is, because I'm old and I forget things, I open my calendar on my phone, and I look to see what's in store for the next day and the week. So I know where my day starts in the morning. And if there's nothing on my calendar in particular and it's a study day, I'll make sure CJ doesn't need anything or what's going on with her, so I know what to do. We wake up in the morning and we make plans, but we have no knowledge of what the day holds. I can't even begin to tell you how often my plans for the day change. There was a time when it used to frustrate the daylights out of me, but it doesn't anymore. Now I believe that whatever it is, God is doing something, and I just need to do what he's brought my way. What providence does God have in store for us when we get up in the morning? We're not running to the battle. We're just going about our day, just like David. But in order to stand, we have to always be perceptive and ready, suited up for whatever he has placed in our path. I've gotten to the point most of the time, the greater majority of the time, that I start my day out with my plan and follow James' advice and say, Lord willing, so that when that change comes, I'm not overwhelmed by it. If I don't do that, then I go, right, how am I going to do this today? Where am I going to fit this in? But if I'm ready, even though there's no evidence of a change yet, then my heart is settled to accept whatever God brings my way. There is always a bigger and unseen plan at work than the one that we're serving for ourselves. We may be God's chosen instrument for that day. We may be the axe that he's swinging. We may be the stone that he's throwing. So we have to be prepared. Every day when we get up, we represent him, not ourselves. And we are living our life that day in order to show forth his glory, not our own. We resist and they flee only if we do so his way. Not by asserting our own will into the mix. Now, I'm not certain of the meaning of the term in the evil day. I don't know for sure what that means. Some say it's very specific to the end times. I don't know that. Some say it's speaking about the time between his two comings. Ephesians 5, we're not going to read that because we're running late today, but Ephesians 5, 15 through 17 tells us that the days are evil and that we must be prepared every day to honor the Lord in them. That this is a common part of the life that we live, is that we live in an evil world. And evil doesn't take a lunch break. They don't have days off. It's always there. No matter what we see, evil is at work every day, but God's armor will make us able to stand in it, balanced and stable, and able to withstand whatever comes our way in his providence, because providence belongs to him, not our enemy. He sets the day. In him, his way, suited up. That's how we're to take on every single day. When you don't do that, when I don't do that, just like you, I pay the price. And that price never ends up staying with me. It affects how I drive. It affects my reactions to CJ, to whatever it is I have to go do, whatever it is I'm involved in. Unless I see it and I stop and I'm prepared to give God the glory in whatever it is he brings my way. And then I can do it in him, his way, with his power and might, not my own determination. Amen? All right, let's stand for prayer.